Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's October 29th. We're going to finish up muscle physiology today, and next time there's no lecture because you have a test, right? Okay, and then I think we're still scheduled for my boss to come in and visit on the 10th, which will be a week from Monday. To do an evaluation. So come to that. It's good to have good participation in that. All right, so we were talking about skeletal muscle, and we just got done talking about excitation-contraction coupling and the definition of a sarcomere and the important contractile proteins that make up the sarcomere. So when you think of a sarcomere, what are the endpoints? Where does the sarcomere begin and where does it end? The Z-lines or the Z-discs, right? All right, what are the two kinds of contractile proteins within a sarcomere?
Actin and myosin.
Actin and myosin. And which one shortens when a sarcomere contracts? Both of them? Neither of them do. How does a sarcomere shorten then? Actin and myosin slide over each other and it pulls the Z-discs together. That's right. What ion is the signaling compound inside a myofibril that allows cross bridges to form and control sliding of the myofilaments?
Calcium.
That's right. Calcium binds to a protein on the actin molecule that uncovers the myosin binding sites. What's the name of the molecule that binds calcium? Okay. ATP binds to the myosin head and powers the recocking of the myosin head. But yeah, what's the molecule that's the cousin molecule to calmodulin? It's troponin. Yeah, it is troponin. That binds calcium. And then it interacts with another kind of protein that is actually covering up the binding site. But when troponin binds to calcium, it causes a conformation change. And this other molecule gets out of the way so that myosin can bind to actin. What's that other large protein called? That's the tropomyosin. Yeah, so you got to be familiar with troponin, tropomyosin, and actin. Those all come together to make a thin filament, and the thick filament is just made out of myosin. All right, what's another good thing to remember? Where does that calcium come from? The sarcoplasmic reticulum in skeletal muscle. It's released from sarcoplasmic reticulum, which this is a fancy name for smooth ER in skeletal muscle cells. All right. And what causes muscle relaxation? Okay. Okay. What causes relaxation? Titin is important. I'll talk about titin in just a second. I'll go back to titin. I don't know if I like that answer necessarily, but without depolarizations within the T-tubules, the calcium channels of the sarcoplasmic reticulum close, okay? And there is a process that's happening all the time that takes calcium out of the myofibril and puts it back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And that's called the calcium pump, and that requires ATP. So that calcium pump is working all the time, so as soon as the calcium channel is open, calcium is pumped out of the myofibril, and then calcium dissociates from troponin, and then tropomyosin covers up the binding sites, and then cross bridges can't form, and the muscle relaxes as a result, and it goes back to its resting length. Now, what's the protein that causes the sarcomere to go back to its resting length? And that is the titin molecule. It kind of looks like a little spring molecule. All right, so titin is important for the elastic properties of all skeletal muscle. Okay. Well, let's talk about some of the contractile properties of skeletal muscle, right, which is kind of different than what we've considered in other kinds of phenomena that we've looked at. So let's talk about a twitch, a muscle twitch. So when a muscle is stimulated, it contracts, right, it produces tension. And so what we're measuring on this graph right here is the amount of tension that's being produced over time. So it's tension versus time right here. A lot of these diagrams that we looked at is actually what, voltage versus time when we look at an action potential or something. But please focus your attention and realize that this is what a physical measurement of tension that's being produced by a muscle and not electrical activity. All right, so we can stimulate a muscle to contract. If we stimulate it very briefly, it contracts and then it relaxes. But if we stimulate it again a second time before it's fully relaxed, look what happens to the amount of tension that is produced. Is it exactly the same? Like an action potential is what, always the same? But notice this twitch, right, is the second twitch produces more tension than the first twitch. All right, so we call that summation. So this is what happens during summation. So all muscle twitches are not exactly the same. And as a matter of fact, right, I don't can't show it on the slide, so we see summation in each one of these particular cases right here. All right, and if we're going to stimulate a whole muscle, if we increase the voltage of stimulating a muscle, right, we can get even a stronger contraction by recruiting more and more muscle fibers. So a muscle contraction from, say, a muscle like the biceps or brachialis, it's graded depending on the number of muscle fibers that are excited into contracting. And that's important because sometimes you need to lift up a weight that's very, very light, and other times you need to lift up a weight that's very, very heavy. So you have to be able to grade contractions to control your body. Okay, here is another graph of tension produced versus time. And you can see that this muscle is being stimulated repeatedly. And so we see the first contraction is relatively weak, the second contraction is a little bit stronger, the third contraction is stronger yet. All right, and then finally it kind of plateaus out and we just see just very small periods of relaxation in between these contractions right here. All right, so what kind of terminology would you use to describe this upward trend of muscle tension, developing muscle tension right here? Okay, you might say staircase effect. Okay, you might say TREPA. I think you talked about that in lab. All right, but what I want to tell you, this is really summation. Okay, summation. So if you stimulate a muscle before it relaxes, the second contraction, okay, will produce greater contraction. And when it reaches this plateau, this is what we call tetanus. All right, and since it's relaxing in between the periods of excitation, we call this incomplete tetanus. But if we increase the number of shocks per second, all right, notice that there's very little time for the muscle to relax. All right, but we still see a little bit of relaxation, not very much. This is still incomplete tetanus. But if we increase the number of stimulations very, very fast, notice that the muscle contracts, all the contractions summate, and it reaches a plateau without any relaxation whatsoever. And if you have a muscle contracting without relaxation whatsoever, that's what we call complete tetanus. But eventually, what does this muscle need to keep contracting? It needs ATP, right? And when a muscle is contracting, it just turns into a big solid mass, and blood can't get into it, right? Even though it's contracting, it's using up ATP. Blood can't get into it, so what does that mean about the ATP stores within that muscle? They're going to decrease, right, because in blood you have oxygen. Oxygen is necessary for oxidative phosphorylation. So ATP concentration is going to decrease, and eventually the muscle is going to fatigue due to decreases in energy. There's going to be changes in pH of the muscle, which then change the amount of force that muscle can develop. All right, so that's how we would describe fatigue.
I have a question.
Yeah.
When we are at complete
tetanus. Like right here.
Is it when the muscle has built a lot of lactic acid and it starts to cramp and that's when it starts fatiguing? So is it due to the
lactic acid? So for instance, right here where the arrow is, the muscle is being perfused with blood normally because it's not contracted, so there would be very little lactic acid in the muscle at this point in time.
Yeah.
And as soon as it starts contracting, right, it's using up ATP. But the other thing that's happening is that blood is cut off. And so the metabolism of these muscle cells is switching from aerobic metabolism to anaerobic metabolism. So right in this period of time, sure, lactic acid is going to start to build up. Right in this period of time. And as it builds up, that's going to inhibit the force of contraction. But there are also pH changes inside the muscle. Right, ATP concentration decreases, and inorganic phosphate concentration increases, and ADP increase. All of these things contribute to fatigue of the muscle. So, and one would be the buildup of lactic acid and the decrease in pH within the muscle produces this fatigue over here. All right, so fatigue is really a result of the biochemistry within the muscle, and that, say, of neurotransmitters at the neuromuscular junction, but it's just due to the biochemistry within a muscle fiber. All right, so that takes us to the next topic, and that is the length-tension relationship in muscle. And this is important for skeletal muscle, but it's going to be really crucial in your understanding of how cardiac muscle works and even how we treat somebody that's in cardiac failure. All right, so we're going to talk about that in about two or three chapters in the future. Well, the strength of muscle contraction, that means the force that it can generate, is influenced by a number of things. We saw that the frequency of stimulation, right? If the frequency of stimulation increases, then summation takes place, and the tension developed increases up to that plateau region. Another thing that determines the strength of muscle contraction is the thickness of each muscle fiber. Right? So as the muscle fiber increases, that just means that you can put more organelles of contraction within one muscle cell. And what's that organelle of contraction called? The myofibril. So if you have a muscle cell and you put more myofibrils in it, then you have more sarcomeres contracting, so of course it's going to be able to produce more tension. Right? Even though the number of cells doesn't change. If they get thicker, that means you have more myofibrils in there, and that's going to produce a stronger contraction. The other thing that is not so intuitive until you look at it with a little bit of a critical eye is that the strength of contraction is due to the initial length of the muscle fiber. So the resting length of the muscle fiber determines how much tension that fiber can actually generate. And there is an ideal resting length which can generate a maximum force. So let's take a look at a graph of just tension as a percentage of the resting length of a muscle fiber. So at a 100%, okay, that means that the muscle is not being stretched and it's not allowed to recoil at all. So this is the normal resting length of this particular muscle. Right? And if we stimulate it to contract, it's going to produce what will normalize to a tension of 1. So we're going to compare all of our measurements to this particular length right here. All right, and if we stretch the muscle a little bit to 20% greater, right, so we're going to stretch it 20%, look what happens to this strength of contraction. Does it stay the same, or does it increase or decrease? It increases a little bit as we stretch a muscle fiber. All right, well, let's go back to the resting length, and let's let that muscle shorten. All right, so here is shortened down to 80% of its resting length, and guess what happens to the force of contraction? All right, it actually decreases. And then if we let that muscle shrink even further to 60% of its resting length, look what happens to the amount of tension that it can develop. Hardly none whatsoever. So that's kind of a strange effect. And in order to understand this effect, you have to be able to visualize the contractile proteins that make up the sarcomere. All right, so in order for Z lines to come together, don't forget actin and myosin have to slide over each other, right? And if the actin and myosin, because the muscle is so short, if the myosin extends already from Z line to Z line, the sarcomere is as short as it can possibly get at that point in time. So it can't contract any further. So here we have a diagram, an illustration of what a shortened sarcomere looks like, okay, at probably around 70% of its resting length. Notice this sarcomere right here can't generate any tension because actin and myosin can't slide over each other, even though cross bridges can form, right? Myosin still can attach to actin, right? But the Z lines can't get any closer together, so it can't produce any tension. But if we stretch this sarcomere out a little bit, okay, so now here we're at about 120% of its resting length, we still see sufficient overlap of actin and myosin, so cross bridges can form, all right, but what can happen now? There's still plenty of room for actin and myosin to slide over each other, for the Z disks to come together, and for this sarcomere to produce tension. But on the other hand, if we go way out to about 170% of its resting length, we really stretch it out, so we stretched out the sarcomere, what can you tell me about the overlap of actin and myosin in this particular case? There's no overlap whatsoever. So the myosin heads have no actin to bind to. And as a result, this sarcomere can't produce any tension because this muscle is way too stretched out to produce any kind of tension. Okay. So this graph right here, we see that here is an optimal region for a muscle to produce tension. And then this is the ascending limb of producing tension, and here is the descending limb of producing tension. And the optimal region right here is just determined by the optimal overlap of actin and myosin, so you get the maximum amount of cross bridge formation, but still allowing the actin and myosin to slide over each other, which can't happen in this case over here. Okay, so the resting length of a muscle is very important in determining the force of contraction. Okay, who's got a question? Do you look bewildered? Oh, this middle one right here? This is an optimal resting length because you still have sufficient overlap. You still have many, many cross bridges that can form between actin and myosin, but you still have a lot of room for the filaments to slide over each other as well. And that's going to produce the maximum amount of tension in this muscle. Okay. All right, let's talk about the neural control of skeletal muscle. All right, so skeletal muscle is controlled by somatic motor neurons, right? And these motor neurons have cell bodies in the ventral horn of the spinal cord, and these axons leave the, how many roots does the spinal cord have? Two. What are these two roots?
Dorsal.
The dorsal and ventral, and the dorsal root is what kind of root in terms of function? It's sensory, so the ventral root is motor. Hopefully this is coming back to you a little bit, right? So somatic motor neurons have to leave the ventral root because that's the only way these neurons can leave the central nervous system. And indeed, those cell bodies are in the ventral horn. And eventually, they're going to leave the spinal cord. These are called the lower motor neurons, right? And they form a final common pathway to a skeletal muscle. The activity of these motor neurons is influenced by feedback, by response loops from muscles and tendons. So you can tell a muscle to contract, but it should contract in a proper and appropriate way. And the way that your body adjusts for that appropriateness is by using feedback. Right? So some of that feedback is facilitatory, sometimes it's inhibitory with these upper motor neurons. All right, so the way that your central nervous system knows how a muscle is contracting is that there has to be a receptor in muscles that can tell the central nervous system what the length of that muscle is and what the tension in that muscle is. All right, so there is a special receptor called a muscle spindle apparatus that is responsible for determining the length of a muscle, whether it's stretching or not. And there are other sensory receptors that can measure the amount of tension that a muscle is producing. So the length receptor is what we call a muscle spindle apparatus, And the tension receptor is what we call the Golgi tendon organ. Golgi tendon organ versus muscle spindle apparatus. So the muscle spindle apparatus is more associated with skeletal muscles, and the Golgi tendon organs are more associated and inserted into the tendons that attach muscles to bone. So here we have a picture of a muscle spindle apparatus. And if we look right here, what does this look like to you, where I have the cursor? What kind of stands out right here? It's nice skeletal muscle, right? It's striated. You see some sarcomeres in here. All right, and then we see this encapsulated receptor, and it has modified skeletal muscle cells in there, and you can see some of them are very striated, others are not so striated. All right, and what I want you to know about the muscle spindle is that we see that it's very, very close to the tendon, but it's really part of the muscle itself. All right, it is encapsulated, and the usual muscle fibers that make up this muscle are what we call the extrafusal fibers, and the fibers of the muscle spindle apparatus itself are what we call the intrafusal fibers. So we got extrafusal, which are the muscles that are used to produce tension for your movement, all right? And then the other muscle fibers right here are the ones that are designed to measure length within this muscle. So these really don't develop tension, right? So the extrafusal fibers develop tension. The intrafusal fibers of the muscle spindle apparatus are just there to measure the length of the muscle. All right, so we got a couple, and so I don't want you to know the different kinds of intrafusal fibers or the different kinds of receptors, but I want to just go over some of the basic rules for how a muscle spindle operates. All right, so in order to get a muscle to contract, whether it's an intrafusal fiber or an extrafusal fiber, what do we need? We need some kind of stimulus, an action potential reaching an axon terminus. So here we have neuromuscular junctions on the extrafusal fibers, and we have neuromuscular junctions on the intrafusal fibers. And when these junctions get stimulated, then of course that's going to cause muscle contraction, right? For these fibers to contract. All right, so the motor neuron that goes to the extrafusal fiber, these are the ones that produce tension in your body and contract. That's what we call an alpha motor neuron. And there are also motor neurons, but different ones that go to the intrafusal fibers, and we call those the gamma motor neurons. So we got gamma fibers and alpha fibers. The alpha go to the regular somatic muscle, right, and the gamma go to the intrafusal fibers. But that's not all we have. We also have special receptors within the spindle apparatus, and I'm not going to ask you to know the different kinds of receptors. Right here is a secondary sensory neuron. Here's a primary sensory neuron right here. But you see they're attached to different kinds of receptors, and these different receptors respond to different kinds of stretch. Whether it's going to be a tonic stretch or a rapid stretch, these different kinds of receptors respond in a little bit different way, but nonetheless, they're all going to respond to stretch. Yeah. The alpha fiber goes to the regular somatic skeletal muscles that you use for contract, that you use to move your body around. And the gamma fibers go to the muscle spindle fibers, which we call the intrafusal fibers. All right, so the alpha go to the extrafusal, and the gamma goes to the intrafusal fibers. And the intrafusal fibers have receptors for stretch in them. Okay. Right, and so the muscle spindles are arranged in parallel with the extrafusal fibers. They're just inserted right within the muscles within, or the muscle fibers within a muscle. All right, so I think I talked about these alpha motor neurons, the gamma motor neurons we talked about, and since we have these gamma motor neurons associated with the spindle apparatus, this increases the sensitivity of muscle to passive stretch. So this is a way for your central nervous system to know if a muscle is stretching inappropriately. Okay, the upper motor neurons usually stimulate the alpha fibers, right? The alpha, where do the alpha motor neurons go to? The extrafusal fibers, and those extrafusal fibers cause tension and allow your body to move, right? But the upper motor neurons also send signals out to the gamma motor neurons simultaneously. We call this co-activation. So both the intrafusal and extrafusal fibers are told to contract at the same time, although the gamma motor neurons are a little bit slower. All right, so stimulation of the alphas, because they go to the extrafusal fibers, that causes muscle contraction and shortening. All right, and stimulation of the gamma motor neuron causes the intrafusal fibers to take up the slack, right, because of the following reason. So look at the board I have right here. I have three different cases of a muscle. So the blue right here just represents the extrafusal fibers. And green represents the intrafusal fibers within a muscle spindle apparatus. So this is the condition we're going to start with. So here's a resting length of a muscle. And let's just look at this muscle if the alphas and gammas weren't co-activated. All right, so if co-activation didn't take place and the skeletal muscle was told to contract, if the extrafusal fibers contracted, what would happen, for instance, if you just think of this as a sarcomere, what would happen to the sarcomere? It would, of course, shorten. Okay, and without signals to the intrafusal fibers, what would happen to the length of this intrafusal fiber right here if it was not told to contract along with the extrafusal fiber? It would stay its initial length, okay, and what would happen to the tension of that muscle? It would completely, what, disappear. It would be completely slack, and it would just form these little bends right there. All right, and now let's think about if we were now to stretch this muscle, would there be any increase in tension in this intrafusal fiber? If we were to stretch this muscle, like in this particular case, almost back to the resting length, look what happens to this intrafusal fiber. There's still no tension on it, right? So there's no tension when the muscle is contracted, and when it's stretched inappropriately, there's still no tension. So this particular circumstance can't provide any feedback to your central nervous system that the muscle is being stretched. All right, so in order for this muscle to send information back, so what has to happen to this intrafusal fiber right here? It has to be told to contract so that it develops a little bit of tension so that when it's stretched, all right, so when the sarcomere is stretched, then that definitely puts tension on those receptors, right? So now you're really stretched out, and those receptors send information back to the central nervous system saying, the muscle spindle is being stretched. So the extrafusals and intrafusal fibers have to be co-activated so that tension is always maintained, right, on either end of these muscle spindle apparatus. So let's look and see why this is important. So here we have a monosynaptic stretch reflex, and it consists of just one synapse in the central nervous system. So let's consider maybe the quadriceps muscle right here, and here is the tendon of the quadriceps, and you can think of all the muscles of the quadriceps. I'd probably only see one right here, and here's the patella, and then here's the patellar ligament inserting into the tibial tuberosity. And so initially, this muscle has the proper tension, okay, to maintain your body posture, whether you're sitting or standing. And the intrafusal fibers within the muscle spindle apparatus have tension applied to them because they have been co-activated with the extrafusal fibers. So they just have the proper length, producing the proper tension. And now, let's just say that there's some perturbation to this muscle. Unexpectedly, all of a sudden, it starts to stretch. Maybe somebody bumps into you, or you lose your balance, right? Or another way to just simulate that with a little experiment is just have somebody tap the patellar ligament, which puts tension on the patella, that puts tension on the tendon of the quadriceps, and that stretches all of the extrafusal fibers. But because the intrafusal fibers are matched exactly in length, what happens to these extrafusal fibers? They get stretched as well. And so those receptors in the muscle spindle, so here are the receptors in the muscle spindle, they start to fire action potentials to the central nervous system, saying that the quadriceps is stretching. Right? They come in, the dorsal root synapse directly on an alpha motor neuron. Right? So this is releasing an excitatory neurotransmitter, and this sends action potentials down this alpha motor neuron. And where does the alpha motor neuron end up? What kind of fibers? You got either what, the intrafusal or extrafusal? These are outside of the muscle spindle, so these are the extrafusal fibers, and this causes the quadriceps to contract, thereby protecting this muscle right here. All right, so this is a very, very fast reflex, only requires one synapse, one sensory neuron, and one motor neuron. And that produces what? The knee-jerk reflex. That produces extension of the knee. So that's what protects this muscle and the knee joint from inappropriate stretching of this particular muscle, maintaining posture and balance. So this is a monosynaptic reflex. All right, so the stretch reflex is due to which one of the receptors that we are about to talk about? The muscle spindle apparatus or the Golgi tendon organ? Okay, it relates to the muscle spindle apparatus because that's the one that is monitoring length or stretch of a muscle. Okay, the Golgi tendon organ is a little bit different. It measures tension. So let's just see how the Golgi tendon reflex works. Okay, so this is not just a simple monosynaptic reflex, but this is a disynaptic reflex. So this requires an interneuron. And here is an interneuron. Interneurons are completely found in the central nervous system. They're never partly in the peripheral nervous system. Right, and Golgi tendon organs are found in tendons, and they're responsible for their mechanoreceptors that can monitor tension. Right, and you'll see that this is a little bit different. So here is a sensory neuron that measures the amount of tension in this tendon. So when it sends action potentials into the central nervous system, it stimulates the interneuron. Right, so it releases excitatory neurotransmitter, but the interneuron in this particular case is an inhibitory neuron. So it's going to release inhibitory neurotransmitter, right, which then inhibits this alpha motor neuron. And so what happens to this muscle right here when it's inhibited, when the alpha motor neuron is inhibited? Does it contract or does it relax? It relaxes. Right, so the Golgi tendon organ right here and the Golgi tendon organ reflex is designed to prevent the development of too much tension on this tendon right here so that it doesn't rip the tendon or pull off the bone, for instance. All right, and that's due to this inhibitory interneuron. So it prevents excessive muscle contraction and passive muscle stretching in that way. Now, why might that be important? Well, let's just say that you bought some furniture, okay? I don't know, something heavy, like a big desk, which you can't possibly lift by yourself. So you need help, right? So you ask your friend to help you lift this desk up, and so both of you lift the desk up, and so each of you have about half of the weight of the desk that you're carrying, right? So you're carrying it into your house, and then all of a sudden, something happens to your friend and it slips out of his hand. All right, so now where's all the weight of the desk? It's kind of right on you. All right, and if you hold on to the desk with all that weight, you could actually damage all of those muscles and all of those tendons. Right, but you have these Golgi tendon organs right here that now measure that huge increase in tension, right, which is going to damage your body. That sends action potentials to the spinal cord, activates this inhibitory neuron, and inhibits this alpha motor neuron, so what is your response going to be, even without your knowing? Yeah, your muscles are going to relax. Of course, the desk is going to fall to the ground, but at least you don't damage any tendons, okay, and muscles as a result of that. Okay, so this is a little bit different kind of reflex than the stretch reflex that we talked about, the Golgi tendon organ reflex, right, which is a disynaptic reflex for different purposes. All right, so that takes us to cardiac muscle and smooth muscle. And if you were to look at this slide right here, you could probably tell me what kind of muscle is this. Is this cardiac or smooth muscle? Yeah. It's cardiac muscle. How could you tell it's cardiac muscle? Yeah. It's got striations, right? You learned that. And you might say, well, gee whiz, I could ask you, how come you know this is not skeletal muscle? Because skeletal muscle is striated as well. How would you know this is cardiac and not skeletal muscle? Oh, okay, because here are some intercalated discs. So cardiac muscle cells are short, right? Skeletal muscle cells are really long. Another feature that we see right here is that cardiac muscle is branched. Here I can see a branch. And here I see another branch. And skeletal muscle is just long and linear. It's just a fiber. Okay? And these intercalated discs have special junctions in them that glue the cells together so that when this cell on the right contracts, it can pull on the one on the left without pulling apart. That's really important, so that tension can be applied throughout this whole layer, for instance, of the heart. The other things that we have in a intercalated disc are gap junctions. And these gap junctions are basically sodium channels. So it allows for sodium to directly diffuse from one cell to the next. So, for instance, if on the cell on the right, if we cause the cell on the right to depolarize by, what, allowing a sodium current to enter the cell, maybe through voltage-gated channels or whatever, what happens to the sodium that enter the cell on the right? It can pass right through a gap junction and enter the cell on the left. And what do we typically call that process when sodium enters a cell? That's depolarization, right? So depolarization of the cell on the right causes depolarization of the cell on the left, which is an excitatory event, which is going to cause contraction of both of these cells. All right. The other thing that you should notice, because these cells are branched, that depolarization just doesn't travel right on the surface of the heart, but it can move to deeper and deeper levels because these cells are all branched, right? So if this cell depolarizes, this one depolarizes, and then this one depolarizes, and down through different layers within the heart. So that's why cardiac muscle can't be long and linear. It has to be branched. All right, the other thing about cardiac muscle is that you only need to depolarize one cell within the heart, and what happens to all of the muscle cells within the heart? They depolarize, and then they all contract together. Right, so the heart contracts as a unit. We'll look at the coordination of the heart contraction a little bit in the next chapter, all right? But basically, you only need one cell to contract, and that will force all of the cells in the heart to contract, unlike skeletal muscle, right? So skeletal muscle has what kind of synapse? What is the neuromuscular junction? What kind of synapse is that? The neuromuscular junction is it's a chemical synapse, right? And this is a synapse, but what kind of synapse is a gap junction? That's an electrical synapse, right? So it's passing information as a sodium current or as an electrical event from one cell to the other. All right, and it's real important for skeletal muscle to have chemical synapses and not electrical synapses, because what were to happen if all of your skeletal muscles were connected with electrical synapses? Yeah, every time you cause one skeletal muscle cell to depolarize, all of your muscle cells would depolarize and you would just go into convulsions, right? So you couldn't really control your body. The heart doesn't have to work that way, and it should contract as a unit. As a matter of fact, in order to pump blood, it really has to contract as a unit. All right, so that's the importance of these gap junctions right here. All right, so it allows action potentials to spread throughout the cardiac muscle. All right, let's think about excitation-contraction coupling in cardiac muscle. So cardiac muscle is sort of similar to skeletal muscle, right? Except it does not have ryanodine receptors between voltage-gated calcium channels in the T-tubules. They're not mechanically connected to calcium channels in sarcoplasmic reticulum. The sarcoplasmic reticulum in cardiac cells is not as extensive as what you've seen in skeletal muscle, right? Remember, the sarcoplasmic reticulum forms triads, right? And a lot of terminal cisternae, and it's a very extensive network. That's not so for cardiac muscle. And some calcium actually enters, right, myofibrils from outside of the cell, from an extracellular source. So calcium comes from an extracellular source as well as a little bit from the sarcoplasmic reticulum and cardiac muscle. All right, but the rest of the excitation-contraction coupling scheme is the same. Cardiac muscle has troponin, and when troponin binds calcium, that allows cross bridges to form between actin and myosin, just like in skeletal muscle, and the actin and myosin will slide over each other. And then, all right, as if these calcium channels close because there's no action potentials coming down, opening these voltage-gated calcium channels, then calcium is pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum as well as outside of the cell, then the cardiac muscle is going to relax. And due to the elastic properties of sarcomeres, then the heart is going to dilate. So this is sort of similar, all right? But just remember, there is not quite so much extensive sarcoplasmic reticulum in cardiac muscle compared to skeletal muscle. And the sarcomere is basically the same, right? Sarcomeres are defined as being between two Z lines, right, and these sarcomeres line up from end to end of the cell, and so cardiac muscle looks striated as a result of that as well. All right, so I think that's all I want to say about cardiac muscle. Was there something else I wanted to say? No, but nonetheless, appreciate how important calcium is for cardiac muscle to contract. Right, so if you were going to choose where to have, if you're running low on calcium, where would you like to have the proper levels of calcium? In your heart or in your bones? In your heart, right? So bones, again, are sacrificed when you start to run out of calcium as we get older to just to preserve myocardial function. Okay. All right, that takes us to smooth muscle. And if we look at smooth muscle in this micrograph right here, all right, do you see any striations? There are no striations. And that means that there are no sarcomeres that you're familiar with in smooth muscle. There still is actin and myosin. Actin and myosin still slide over each other, but the arrangement of these contractile proteins is a lot different. All right, so we don't have Z lines or Z discs in smooth muscle. But what we do have are proteins embedded in the plasma membrane, kind of laid out as a network on the surface of the cell, and these are called dense bodies. Attached to the dense bodies are actin filaments. All right, so we have actin filaments on this dense body, actin filaments on this dense body over here, and in between the actin filaments, we have myosin. So the arrangement is kind of similar to a sarcomere, but it's absent the Z discs. All right, so this kind of arrangement allows for a smooth muscle cell to stretch to a greater degree compared to skeletal muscle, but it also means that a smooth muscle cell can also shorten to a greater degree because of this arrangement right here. And you have myosin and actin pretty much in the same arrangement. Then these cross bridges can form when calcium floods this area right here. All right, so calcium is still important for controlling contraction of smooth muscle, but it's a lot different control mechanism. Smooth muscle does not have troponin. It's got the molecule called calmodulin. All right, so that calcium also comes from outside the cell. Smooth muscle doesn't have any smooth endoplasmic reticulum or sarcoplasmic reticulum at all. So calcium enters through voltage-gated channels that are in the plasma membrane when the cell depolarizes, right? Calcium then binds to calmodulin, and I want to describe a series of events probably by looking at this diagram right here. All right, so I just don't want to read those two slides to you, but let's look at this diagram. All right, so if we have a cell, a smooth muscle cell, and if it's stimulated, right, and reaches threshold, that triggers the voltage-gated channels, which causes these action potentials, right, that causes depolarization. And that depolarization opens up voltage-gated calcium channels in the plasma membrane of the smooth muscle cells. So calcium does what? Calcium enters the cell from the extracellular fluid. And then it binds to calmodulin. This is a compound that's going to change metabolism inside the cell. So this calmodulin-calcium complex is going to bind, okay, is actually going to dephosphorylate something we call myosin light chain kinase. It's going to dephosphorylate it, turning myosin light chain kinase into an active form. All right, so what does a kinase do? What does a kinase do? Can you remember a kinase? It runs around and phosphorylates something. And what it phosphorylates is actually a part of the myosin molecule, and the part that is phosphorylated is what we call the light chain, as opposed to the heavy chain. So there are different components that make up myosin. Some of the components are heavy, some are light, and the one that's important for regulating contraction is the lighter of the components, the one that's not so weighty. All right, so myosin light chain kinase, when it becomes activated because calmodulin is bound to calcium, it phosphorylates the myosin. Okay, and when myosin is phosphorylated in smooth muscle, then cross bridges can form. So that's a different kind of scenario compared to skeletal muscle, right? So cross bridges form in skeletal and cardiac muscle when tropomyosin gets out of the way. That's not how smooth muscle works. Smooth muscle can contract when myosin is phosphorylated, and it's phosphorylated by this myosin light chain kinase, right, as a result of calcium entering the cell. All right, so the muscle contracts. And the ATPase in myosin of smooth muscle is very slow compared to the myosin ATPase in skeletal muscle. So smooth muscle contracts a lot more slowly compared to skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle. So it contracts much more slowly. All right, and in order for smooth muscle to relax, right, this myosin light chain has to be dephosphorylated. This phosphate has to come off. What's the name of an enzyme that causes dephosphorylation? Phosphatase. All right, so myosin phosphatase is active pretty much all the time inside smooth muscle cells, and it's competing against myosin light chain kinase. Right, so when calcium levels start to decline in the cell, because the cell is not depolarizing, then myosin light chain kinase gets converted into myosin light chain kinase that's phosphorylated, and then myosin phosphatase activity can take over, and if it dephosphorylates myosin, then you have an inactive myosin, cross bridges can't form, and smooth muscle starts to relax. All right, so phosphorylation of cross bridges leads to contraction. Dephosphorylation leads to relaxation of smooth muscle. All right, so we don't have troponin in smooth muscle. What do we have instead that's able to be sensitive to calcium levels inside the cell? What's the regulatory molecule in smooth muscle that's sensitive to calcium? It's calmodulin. What's the regulatory molecule in cardiac and skeletal muscle that's sensitive to calcium levels? It's troponin, right? And How does troponin work? It changes the conformation of tropomyosin, and it allows cross bridges to form as a result. All right, so the mode of activation is quite a bit different between these different types of muscle. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit more about different kinds of smooth muscle that we have. All right, single unit is spontaneously active. We say that it's myogenic. Some cells that have smooth muscles act like pacemaker cells, and some smooth muscles have gap junctions between them that spread electrical activity right through those gap junctions. All right, so that's one kind of smooth muscle. Right, it has gap junctions. So we call that single unit because the whole smooth muscle, all those hundreds or thousands of smooth muscle cells, are going to work together because they're connected by gap junctions. So they perform, or they behave, as a single unit. Multi-unit smooth muscle, okay, requires nerve stimulation by the autonomic nervous system. And what can you tell me about the autonomic nervous system? How many parts are there? There's two, right? There is the sympathetic and parasympathetic, and they're antagonistic to each other, right? One is inhibitory, the other is going to be excitatory. And the autonomic nervous system releases different kinds of neurotransmitters depending on which division it is. All right. The other thing is that the axons of the autonomic nervous system don't have axon terminals. They have varicosities. So they form synapses that we call synapses en passant, or in passing. All right. So here we have a diagram that shows the different kinds of smooth muscle. The top one is what we call single unit smooth muscle. All right, and so I want you to appreciate, why do we call this single unit smooth muscle? If this muscle cell right here depolarizes, what happens to all of these smooth muscle cells? They all depolarize because of these gap junctions. So all of these cells act as a single unit. All right, and these muscle cells are autorhythmic. They can contract on their own, but they can be influenced by neurotransmitters from this single autonomic neuron, right? All right, so this is single unit. For instance, within the walls of the digestive tract. Multi-unit smooth muscle, we see, do you see any gap junctions between these cells? No, so they can contract independently of each other, so that's what we call this a multi-unit. Each one is a unit all by themselves, right? And these are innervated by the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system. And look, we don't have axon terminals, but we have these swellings along an axon. These swellings are what we call varicosities, and they contain synaptic vesicles. So when an action potential comes down and depolarizes the membrane, that causes release of neurotransmitter at each one of these varicosities. And that neurotransmitter can be excitatory or it can be inhibitory depending on the kind of receptor, right, that it binds to. And that different receptors will open up different kinds of ion channels. If it opens up a sodium channel, all right, what's going to be the response? Inhibition or excitation? Excitation. If it results in opening of a potassium channel, then it's going to inhibit the cell and it won't contract. Okay. So those are the two kinds of smooth muscle cells, single unit versus multi-unit. It needs calcium as a signal for contraction, but you should realize that that calcium signal comes from the extracellular fluid in smooth muscle and not smooth endoplasmic reticulum inside the smooth muscle cell. The other thing that's important to realize, right, and that is when, I don't know how far back I have to go. Let me see. This is good enough. So when we have an action potential coming down this somatic motor neuron, releasing acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction, all right, and that's a nicotinic receptor, what's always going to be the response of this skeletal muscle? It's going to contract, right? So it's going to open up a sodium channel and thousands and thousands of sodium channels, that's always going to result in an action potential on the surface of this skeletal muscle cell causing contraction. Right, so skeletal muscle can never make up its own mind what to do. It just contracts. On the other hand, what about smooth muscle? It is sensitive to excitatory signals and inhibitory signals. So smooth muscle can make up its mind on its own whether it's going to contract depending on the information that's provided to it. So smooth muscle, in a sense, is a lot smarter because it listens to both the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system for directions and then makes up its own mind if it's going to contract or not, or maybe it will adjust the frequency of contraction or the force of contraction. So that's a big difference between skeletal muscle and smooth muscle. Okay, it can grade contractions as a result. All right, so that's it for this particular chapter. All right. So that takes us to one of the more fun chapters in the book. All right, so we're passing around the sign-in sheet. I got the sign-in sheet right here. Anybody need the sign-in sheet? Before I move on to the next chapter, I might ask and see if there's any kinds of questions. All right, so muscle, no one needs the sign-in sheet. So let's see, muscle, is muscle on the test on Tuesday?
No.
No, it's not. Okay, so what we just got done talking about is not on the test. That will be on your next one. All right?
Okay. Can you go into the release of troponin, like during a heart attack at all?
Okay. When blood supply to any organ is cut off, right, it's losing oxygen. And oxygen is necessary to make ATP. Okay? And ATP is necessary to keep the cell healthy in all kinds of different ways. It keeps the pumps working, and it keeps the biochemistry inside the cells working properly so that the cell can maintain membranes so that they don't become leaky. Right? But when you cut off oxygen, one thing that happens is that lysosomes start to degrade, the plasma membrane of the cell starts to degrade. And what's inside of a lysosome?
Digestive
enzymes. So it actually hastens the demise of that cell because it starts to digest proteins and other things that are inside the cell, which further destabilizes the plasma membrane and other lysosomes and things like that. So when a cell is cut off from oxygen, it becomes very leaky. And the components inside the cell, since they're being chopped up, can break out from the plasma membrane that is being destroyed. Right? So in muscle, there are various kinds of components inside the cell that start to leak out. And one of the things that's kind of handy is troponin. Troponin is a protein. And cardiac muscle has a different kind of troponin than skeletal muscle. It has a little bit different arrangement to it. So when skeletal muscle is damaged, troponin can leak out. Right? When cardiac muscle is damaged, the cardiac troponin can leak out into the blood, and then when we take a blood sample from somebody, we can tell if it's a skeletal muscle that's damaged because it has that kind of troponin in the blood versus maybe a heart attack, which has a different form of troponin. So we can tell where the damage is occurring, maybe in a skeletal muscle or heart muscle. And depending on the level of these compounds, we can get an estimate of the severity of the damage to the heart. So if there's a lot of heart troponin floating around in the blood, right, you know it's a massive heart attack. If there's just a little bit, then you know it's kind of a slight heart attack. And you know it's a heart attack because it has the right shape of the troponin that comes from the heart. But there are other compounds that leak out as well. And those can be used to diagnose where the insult is, it a heart attack or not a heart attack. Troponin is one molecule. Yeah. And those are all determined by, I don't know if you do any electrophoresis in lab. I don't think we do any electrophoresis in lab, but it could be an electrophoresis technique that monitors what kind of protein conformation it is, or maybe even immunological kind of test, which is based on the shape of molecules. So the different troponins have just a little bit different shape that can be monitored. Yeah. So that's a place to start. That's an easy test to do. And probably want to get a more proper test, like some kind of imaging studies of the heart, and maybe a thallium scan to see how much of the heart is damaged. That's a radioactive kind of test, but a blood test is what a nice simple thing that can be done very fast. I don't know how it changes patient management, though. Because if you have a heart attack, probably the most important thing is to do some angioplasty, get an angiogram, and just look at the blood vessels going to the heart. And then from that determine, well, if we open up this blood vessel, will that help the heart or won't it help the heart? Okay, so angioplasty still is kind of the gold standard. But to do that, you can't do that in just a minute, right? You need to find the doctors that can thread the stuff around. You need like a little pseudo-surgical suite and all the instruments to be sterile. But to take blood is what? Really fast and easy to do. Yeah. Yeah.
Is this faster than the artery?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to clear up the clot?
Well, you would just say diet and exercise. But I'm not aware of any good scientific evidence that say that those plaques are reversible. I think you can prevent the progression of the disease by, of course, diet and exercise, and especially managing cholesterol and LDL levels. And cholesterol and HDL are linked to diet and exercise. And cholesterol can be managed with other kinds of drugs like statins, for instance. But there's other kinds of disease processes that involve calcium and the lining of blood vessels, so it's just not cholesterol. And we're just learning about all of these different things. The more calcium and cholesterol that build up in a blood vessel means that they're more fragile. And that really has some terrible implications, unfortunately. If you do angioplasty on somebody maybe has a narrowing of a blood vessel in their heart, and we can thread a little tiny balloon to that narrowing, blow the balloon up, and squish the plaque open a little bit. So if it's a nice mushy cholesterol plaque, you know, it squishes open really nice. But if there's a lot of calcium and it's a very fragile artery, instead of the artery expanding and getting smushed open, it just fractures. And then that's a really terrible circumstance, right? Because it's really, you can't repair that fracture. And that's sort of an interesting area of imaging right now, because, you know, in an MRI unit, you can stick a whole person in an MRI and get a picture of their whole body. It's not a really high resolution, but at least we can see various parts of their brain, and we can see heart and blood vessels. But within an MRI, they're making special little instruments that you can actually put into a blood vessel and make tiny, tiny pictures of just the blood vessel, very high resolution images. And that might tell you what kind of plaque it is. Is it one that it can be treated very nicely with the balloon angioplasty? Or if you do a balloon angioplasty, is it the kind of plaque that's going to fracture into 1,000 pieces? Right, then of course you don't want to do that. Then you want to put a bypass in or something. So, yeah, it depends. Depends on what kind of plaque it is. But that would be really nice if we could find some irreversible treatment. Right, like just take this treatment once a year and wipe out all the plaques in your body and go back to doing whatever you like to do and come back a year later, take that drug and wipe them all out, right? Yeah. Okay, say that again.
On average, bypass
will last. Bypass will last only a certain lifetime? Well, they get old and they get fragile. Okay, and so they'll slowly occlude. You know, anytime you do surgery, you end up with scar tissue. And so probably during that period of time, scar tissue builds up, and that just occludes the blood vessel over time once again. And that scar tissue is not compliant like a regular blood vessel. Right, so it buys time for people, but eventually it's going to wear out, it's going to get brittle, it's going to occlude as well. Yeah. So even if it's an autograft, even if it's a blood vessel that you take from a person and put it back in their body, it won't be rejected, but it still gets older faster compared to other blood vessels around because of scar tissue and other kinds of inflammatory processes involved, which is surgery. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there an office trip, but I was taking this test in one of the class, my lab class.
Yeah.
And she was saying that the results I got, it showed that I had, like, I guess it's like your blood, the sugar fast or whatever.
Okay, they were measuring blood sugar levels?
Yeah, is that hypoglycemia?
Well, there's hyperglycemia if your blood glucose is too high. There's hypoglycemia if your blood sugar is too low.
Yeah.
Okay.
What's the symptoms of that, like your blood sugar is too low?
You know what? It's hard to tell. If you're hypoglycemic or hyperglycemic, sometimes it's hard to tell. But if you're hypoglycemic, you just feel very lethargic. Okay.
So nothing bad.
Over time, yeah, because that could be a sign of, say, diabetes, if your blood sugar is way too high. And when your blood sugar is way too high, that might not sound too bad because you have a lot of sugar. But what does that mean? It means that the sugar that's in your blood isn't getting into the cells of your body because those GLUT4 transporters aren't put in the plasma membrane. So although you have good sugar levels in your blood and your body, what about all the cells? Your cells are starving to death because they're not getting glucose. So if your blood sugar is too high, your cells are basically starving to death as a result of that. Okay, and what are some of the sequelae of that? Well, tissues that need a lot of glucose will die relatively fast, like retinas. So people will go blind. Okay, it will cause, and your heart needs a lot of energy. So the heart is slowly dying, and the brain and the kidneys are dying. Okay, so yeah, blood glucose, it's important to control blood glucose. If you don't have symptoms, you know, it's sort of like high blood pressure. A lot people can live really normal lives and not know that they're a diabetic. Okay, same thing with high blood pressure. So those are some things that should be measured in people, and especially if you have a family history of diabetes.
Yeah. That's rare.
High blood sugar, if you have family history, then yeah, you should get it checked out. And I'll plug our student health service. You know, they're really good in diagnosing or helping diagnose diabetes and managing diabetes. And you can walk over there anytime and they'll help you understand where you are with that. But it definitely has to be managed, just like high blood pressure, because it's just going to kill everything in your body, you know, second by second by second. That's really important to know about, yeah. Hypoglycemia.
Does that mean that you're taking insulin too much, or
are
you just not eating enough?
It could mean you're not eating enough or your tissues are taking in too much. Usually somebody might become hypoglycemic if they're not administering insulin properly. If they give themselves too much insulin, that's going to allow a lot of glucose to enter cells, and it's going to leave the blood, and blood glucose is going to drop as a result. Yep. Okay. So since we're talking about blood, let's talk some more about blood. Okay? Let's sort of get started with blood. Blood in circulation. Okay. All right, so let's talk about just the general functions of the circulatory system. So we'll just get a little head start for a week from today. All right, so functions of the circulatory system. Transports oxygen, nutrients, and enzymes, and hormones from one tissue to another around in your body. Right, it also transports oxygen, that's a waste product, and other waste products away from tissues to be excreted. A lot of things are excreted by the lungs, others require kidneys. Right? The circulatory system also transports heat around in your body for maintaining body temperature. Right? So it's a heat transfer system. The circulatory system also maintains fluid balance and electrolyte balance and pH balance. So for instance, what are some electrolytes? Sodium, potassium, calcium. Are these important in physiology that you know of? What could be an important function of sodium in terms of physiology? Yeah, depolarization. What about calcium? C synaptic transmission, muscle contraction, right? So your circulatory system is important in regulating these electrolyte levels. All right, it also protects your body from disease-causing microorganisms because there are cells in there called white blood cells that fight infection. And another important function of the circulatory system, since blood, what kind of tissue is blood? This is a blast from a previous class. It's connective tissue. It's kind of a strange connective tissue because it's what, a fluid connective tissue. It's not solid. So unfortunately, if there's a hole in a blood vessel, what happens to that connective tissue? It just flows right out because it's a fluid. So another important feature or function of blood is that when a blood vessel gets damaged, there should be some mechanism to plug that hole up so that you don't bleed to death. And so preventing blood loss is real important when a blood vessel is damaged. And unfortunately, they get damaged all the time. And we call that coagulation. Okay. So the components of the circulatory system, all right, include the cardiovascular system, which is the heart and blood vessels, as well as the lymphatic system. And we're not going to spend a whole lot of time with the lymphatic system in here, but that's certainly a part of it, because you have fluid within the lymphatic system, which is what? A major component of blood. All right, so the heart is a pump that develops pressure, and blood flows through the cardiovascular system because a fluid will move according to a constant, according to a pressure gradient. Right? Things will move due to a concentration gradient by what kind of process? Diffusion. Right? And without a concentration gradient, diffusion won't take place. But a fluid won't flow from one area of your body to another unless there is a pressure gradient. So it's sort of like diffusion in that sense. All right, so blood vessels carry blood from the heart, which is high pressure, to cells, and then back again. And the various blood vessels that we have are arteries. What's the definition of an artery? It carries blood away from the heart. Doesn't matter what the chemical composition of blood is, but if it's carrying blood away from the heart, it's an artery. Small arteries we call arterioles, and then those end up in capillaries. And on your notes, you should say what the function of a capillary is. It's got a very special kind of function. Exchange takes place in a capillary. So things can enter or leave the blood only in a capillary. And from anatomy, you should remember that a capillary has a very thin wall. Arteries and veins have a very thick wall, and it stops the diffusion of compounds, right? But capillaries are so thin that things can actually diffuse in and out. And then you have veins. Veins carry blood back to the heart after a capillary. Okay, and venules are just small veins. And all of the fluid that leaks out of a capillary at the proximal end is not resorbed at the distal end. So that means some fluid is left in the tissue spaces every time blood flows through a capillary. And if that fluid wasn't returned to the cardiovascular system, what would happen to you day after day after day? If more fluid was leaking out of your blood than being resorbed, you would swell up. We call that edema. Right? So we don't swell up because there is another part of the circulatory system called the lymphatic system that picks up that excessive fluid that isn't resorbed by capillaries. It's filtered, and then it's returned back to a subclavian vein, returned to your cardiovascular system, right? So that prevents edema in different places, right? And it's the lymph node that filters lymph before it gets back to the heart of bacteria and other kinds of harmful particles. All right, so I could ask you a quick question. All right, these lymph nodes filter out things that don't belong in lymph, maybe cancer cells that are metastasizing through a person's body, and so then cancer develops in a lymph node, and when that cancer is treated, those lymph nodes are removed surgically, all right, along with a particular tumor in some part of your body. What would be a side effect of removing lymph nodes that have cancer in them from somebody? Swelling, edema, because that interrupts the lymphatic system, the return of fluid from that particular part of the body. But that's just a choice, an easy choice you have to make. Right? What would you rather have? Swelling or cancer? Right? Swelling for sure. Okay. But that's just, unfortunately, a side effect of those surgical procedures.
Are you more prone to infections when they remove the...
You know, the question is, are you more prone to infections when you lose lymph nodes? A little bit, all right, but probably not clinically significant. We have so much lymphatic tissue all over our body. If you were to lose a little bit, it probably doesn't affect your immune system very much. Maybe a little bit in that area. So other important lymphatic tissues would be the spleen, right? Is located throughout the intestinal tract, including the appendix. You know, when somebody has appendicitis and the appendix is removed, it really has no consequences whatsoever in their immune system. But if somebody damages their spleen, for instance, and it's removed because you can't sew a spleen back together once it's damaged, you might have to consider that if you're going to have surgeries or if you're going to have implantation of prosthetic devices like screws and bones or plates and things like that, you might be a little bit more susceptible to post-surgical infections. But in everyday normal life, there's probably no difference whatsoever. It's only when you're kind of in an extreme circumstance. Okay? So it's not really a major concern. Yeah.
Why do older people have?
Edema in their older people, edema in their legs. Okay. I think maybe we'll talk about that because there are blood has to flow through the heart in one direction, okay? And so there are things inside the heart that make blood flow only in one direction. What are those things called? Those are valves, right? So we'll learn about the valves, but anatomy, you should know all your valves already. So the heart has valves, but some blood vessels have valves as well. Our arteries don't have valves, capillaries don't have valves, but veins have valves. And sometimes those valves and veins don't work properly, and that happens as we get older. And so blood has a tendency to pool in extremities of older people because the valves and veins don't work right. Because valves are just little flaps. So if a vein starts to expand, to dilate, then the valves can't touch each other. And so what do you have? You have a place for blood to leak back down into an extremity. But if the valves are working, blood can only flow back to the heart. That's probably one of the main reasons. All right, but there could be other reasons too, due to osmotic considerations of the blood, which maybe we'll talk about. I'm not sure. But let's get back to the basics of blood, okay? Blood has basically two components to it. I get to talk for a couple more minutes. All right, there is a fluid component and a cellular component in blood. Right, the cellular component is not what we call the matrix, right? The fluid component is the matrix of the connective tissue, but typically we call that plasma, right? The fluid part of blood is plasma, and most of plasma is water. 92% of it is water. 8% are proteins, and we have albumins and globulins and clotting factors. This albumin right here controls water balance. So if you have a lot of particles in water, like if you have, remember the experiments that you did with hemolysis and crenation, right? If you put a cell, a red blood cell, in a solution that's really, really salty, which way is water going to move? It's going to be sucked out of the cell, right? It's going to move from the cell into the salty solution by osmosis. Well, the particle component of blood, there has to be enough particles in blood to pull water out of tissue spaces, right? So salt and glucose all help, but a major component of that is albumin, right? So you have to have high levels of albumin in blood to withdraw water from tissue spaces, and if that doesn't happen, then you swell up. So that could be another problem with an elderly person. If they're not producing albumins, then blood will, then fluid will stay in tissue spaces and won't be drawn back into the distal end of a capillary. And albumins are made by the liver, so if somebody has liver disease on top of that, then they'll be swollen in all over their body as a result. All right, so anything that affects the liver is going to affect swelling all over the body. All right, globulins fight infections. These other proteins fight blood loss. We're going to talk about that. And then you got, what, all kinds of different ions, nutrients. What's your favorite nutrient? Glucose, yeah, you were dealing with that this week. Various gases, like oxygen, waste products, all right? So, plasma has all of these things. But if we take plasma and subtract out the clotting factors, we take out some of these proteins right here, then plasma cannot coagulate, right? It can't form a plug, and we call that serum. So serum is the fluid part of blood that can't coagulate because the clotting factors are taken out of it. But it still has globulins in it that can fight infections, or maybe if you were envenomated by a poisonous snake or something, there are globulins that can attack the venom and protect your body. That's what we call a serum, right? Or an anti-venom. And then you can be injected with that, because if you're injected with that, that won't ever form a transfusion reaction because it doesn't have any clotting factors in it. All right, the other kind of components are these formed elements, and I guess we're going to start there next time. All right, formed elements.